I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Mitt Romney is delivering a commencement speech this weekend. Will he address his own prep school history? Today, Romney is campaigning in Charlotte, North Carolina, and he's expected to deliver the graduation speech this Saturday at Liberty University, the Christian school founded by Jerry Falwell in Lynchburg, Virginia. But then there was yesterday's report in the Washington Post online about an incident in 1965 at the prestigious Cranbrook School in Michigan, in which a 17-year-old Romney led a posse of kids in attacking and then pinning down a boy to cut his hair. Philip Maxwell, a former classmate who still considers Romney a friend, told ABC News the incident was definitely bullying, saying, "Are you kidding? I castigate myself regularly for not having intervened." Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC World News and co-host of that network's political blog, Tapline, just starts us off today with some thoughts on this. Rick, yesterday Romney said he didn't remember the incident, but he did do dumb things in school, so he apologized to anyone he might have offended. How is this reverberating today?
He's in a tough spot on this because he also says that he remembers this kid well enough to know that he didn't think he was gay, but then to not remember the particular incident is a difficult, maybe untenable position. I think it's got two people split along two sides. One side saying, this was 50 years ago. Every kid does dumb things. There's a statute of limitations that has nothing to do with being the president. The other side saying, this just strains credulity that he doesn't remember this. Why doesn't he at least cop to it and explain it? And if not, maybe that speaks to his character.
Well, and was there some sense that the campaign was anticipating it? Because people are noting that a week ago, Ann Romney suddenly said in the middle of a CBS interview how Mitt Romney was such a prankster in school.
I actually don't think it's anticipation so much as this was maybe a positive that's been turned into a negative. For years now, the Romney camp has been talking about Mitt Romney, the funny jokester prankster that he goes around playing practical jokes, has for years, even decades going back. It's been something they've used to humanize him, to talk about just the sense of humor that doesn't come through with that stiff image of him on the trail. Now, though, it has a much darker pall to talk about this. This is really a classical definition of bullying. If the accounts of these men are true, and again, four of them have gone on the record with the Washington Post, they were all established adults, some are Democrats, some are Republicans, and they all have similar accounts.
Right. And here's some of the response I'm reading online. Sally Cohn, who's a Fox News contributor, says if the press can go after candidate Obama for things in his past, then they can go after Mitt Romney. But Jeremy Meyer, who's from George Mason University, says I think it's a mistake for the Democrats to promote this. It makes them look petty. Should we care that John Kennedy was a bad prom date? Nixon was socially inept. But here's something else someone's writing online. The fact that Romney now says he does not remember speaks volumes. How is it that this prank then weighed heavily on the conscience of others, but he doesn't remember?
That's right. And a lot of people have made the point that Barack Obama, as a teenager, has used drugs, illegal drugs. He's admitted it. And that's a key point. He wrote about it in his autobiography. I think there's a moment here that Mitt Romney could have, if he did indeed remember this, talk about it, or maybe if he didn't, to talk about how he learned and grew based on this experience. But he's issued a basic statement saying that he doesn't remember this happening, but a blanket apology on top of that. So I think it's a difficult one, I think, for any candidate to be confronted by something from their past from almost 50 years ago.
Well, Fox News has released excerpts of Romney's speech ahead of this Saturday commencement at Liberty University, in which the candidate is expected to try to switch the topic back to the economy and families and how important families are. Here's some of the text. Although opportunities seem scarce in this economy, it's not for nothing that you have spent this time preparing, and time with your family will be the important time. Do you think he might, think of also addressing bullying?
I think it's an opportunity because it's a crowd of college graduates to bring that up. Also, gay marriage, which has been in the week. This is an evangelical Christian organization. I think it's a good crowd and maybe good timing to try to do that. But the watchword so far from the Romney campaign is that there's nothing here to get them off a stride. And this is a disciplined organization. They like putting out the message that they want to put out, and they don't like being pushed into something else.
ABC's Rick Klein, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, hoodies are back in the news, not nearly in the important way they were in the Trayvon Martin case, but worth noting. 27-year-old Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg is being criticized for wearing his signature hoodie on his roadshow to pitch Facebook to potential stock buyers as that company prepares to go public next week. Securities analyst Michael Pachter, who was the first to issue a buy recommendation on Facebook stock, told Bloomberg Television that the hoodie is a sign of immaturity, a lack of seriousness, and it doesn't say much for Zuckerberg as a CEO.
I think he is well suited to be the chief product officer, the chief user experience officer, to manage the design of the user interface, to decide every feature that goes in. I'm not sure he's the right guy to run a corporation and have to answer to shareholders.
Where have we heard this before? Oh, yes, Facebook the movie, otherwise known as The Social Network, in which Zuckerberg was portrayed as socially awkward. You may remember this scene in which he responds when being questioned by a lawyer.
It's raining.
I'm sorry?
It just started raining.
Mr. Zuckerberg, do I have your full attention?
No.
Do you think I deserve it?
What?
Do you think I deserve your full attention?
I had to swear an oath before we began this deposition, and I don't want to perjure myself, so I have a legal obligation to say no.
Okay, no. You don't think I deserve your attention?
I think if your clients want to sit on my shoulders and call themselves tall, they have a right to give it a try. But there's no requirement that I enjoy sitting here listening to people lie. You have part of my attention. You have the minimum amount. The rest of my attention is back at the offices of Facebook, where my colleagues and I are doing things that no one in this room, including and especially your clients, are intellectually or creatively capable of doing. Did I adequately answer your condescending question?
Our next guest says, low opinions of Mark Zuckerberg sell him short. Former Wall Street Internet analyst Henry Blodgett, who's written a big piece for New York Magazine entitled How the Brat Tycoon Became a Brilliant CEO, joins us from the Business Insider, which he founded and where he's CEO and editor-in-chief. Henry, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Are you surprised that suddenly there's chat about how Mark Zuckerberg is showing up in a hoodie?
It's amazing. It's become an iconic moment already. It's really people have talked so much more about that over the last 3 days than about the Facebook story and the substance. And very interesting reactions from young people in Silicon Valley when you suggest that he should not have worn a hoodie, or perhaps because he was asking for $10 billion, he might want to have dressed up a little bit. People get angry and say you're just so out of touch and you're a stuffed suit and so forth. And yet on Wall Street, I think the reaction is really, you know, we're not asking for you to crawl and beg, but you know, could you at least be polite?
And you seem to be saying, let me see if I get this right, look beyond the hoodie.
I think you definitely want to look beyond the hoodie. I do think in this case, it might have been nice if Mark put on a collared shirt and a tie, but leave that aside. I don't feel that strongly about it. I think what most people miss about Mark Zuckerberg is that over the last 8 years, in addition to building just an incredible product that is now used by 1/8 of the world's population, which is remarkable, he has become an excellent CEO. And it's been a very difficult process for him. He didn't come into this with particularly good communications or leadership skills. He had to learn. He had to go out and find great mentors and listen to them and figure out how to do this. And yet he has built a great team. And that's why Facebook is the company that it is today.
Well, walk us through this, because what we heard from the analyst, Michael Pachter, sums up the argument that you say you've heard, not just about Zuckerberg, but about other high-tech geniuses that, okay, maybe they can design the product and let them go do that and play, you know, but don't let them be CEOs. This is the story you're also telling when you talk about Mark Zuckerberg. He has transformed himself, but from what? What happened?
Well, if you go back to the 1990s, the model for technology company building in Silicon Valley was that you would take the company founder, who, as one executive described to me, they often have bad hair and they're quirky and they're socially awkward, and sure, they can build great products and program, but come on, let's be serious. These are not the people to lead major global corporations. So you would have them start the company, and then you would bring in what was referred to as a professional CEO to run the company. And that was the model. And some successful companies were built that way. Others lost their way. And Apple is the most famous example of Steve Jobs being thought not ready to run the company. They brought in John Sculley, who was great at selling soda, but in fact was terrible at developing and selling computer products. And Apple crashed. And then Steve Jobs famously brought it back. So there is now a new philosophy among some in Silicon Valley, which is that, no, in fact, you want the founder to stay as CEO because the products are so dynamic and the innovation required to stay at the front line is so rapid that you need a visionary to do that. And what you do is you surround them with great business people. And Facebook is a great model for that. Obviously, Apple was a fantastic model for that. What Steve Jobs did with the company was extraordinary. But this really is suddenly becoming the new way to build technology right. companies.
But you still have to have somebody who, if they're the founder and they genius and they make the products, they still have to be able to run the company. And he wasn't. He wasn't doing very well. You write about a key turning point for Mark Zuckerberg when one of his employees confronted him in a diner at 2:30 in the morning.
That's right. When Facebook reached about 25 people, they had raised a big chunk of money. They were bringing in new people all the time. Suddenly, Mark Zuckerberg began to be seduced and wooed by big media companies in New York. He was spending very little time at the company. And a lot of the people who came in sort of said, wait a minute, who is sailing this ship? And where are we going? And they almost had a mutiny situation. And as you described, the only time that this executive could get with him was in a diner at 2:30 in the morning. And she basically said, look, you want to run this company, you need to take CEO lessons. And one frustration that people always have with Mark Zuckerberg is he doesn't appear to be listening. The body language just doesn't betray anything. But he does, and he very quickly started to apply himself. Suddenly, they had corporate meetings and offsites, and he got clearer about the vision. And very importantly, he has surrounded himself with some excellent executives. And the first one and most important is Sheryl Sandberg, who really runs the company's business.
But before that, before he recruited her from, I believe it was Google?
Correct.
Yeah. He surrounded himself with other advisors. List some of those. And I was trying to picture that, you know, this sort of Obi-Wan Kenobi moments that he might have been having with these other people. Who were they?
That's right. When I started asking people in Silicon Valley about Mark and what a CEO he's like, one of the things that came back very quickly is somebody said, look, he's a sponge. You know, he will find great people and listen to them. Some of those people, one of the first was Don Graham at the Washington Post. Mark was incredibly impressed with the fact that the Washington Post has been around for 100 years and they have this incredibly long-term vision and commitment. They're not focused on the short term. Mark was really impressed by that. So Don Graham is one of those. Others included Steve Jobs, Warren Buffett recently Mark reached out to talk about being a public company. There's many figures that he has reached out to. And so that is becoming part of Facebook. It's the wisdom of a lot of these other folks in Silicon Valley.
It sounds like he also tried to develop a sense of humor, perhaps, piling everybody on buses to go see the Social Network movie.
That's right. I mean, when the Social Network first came into being, I think Facebook was shown either an early script or an early version of it. They were horrified. And his initial attitude was, I'm not going to have anything to do with this. Then in what one person who knows him well described as really a watershed moment for him, he decided that he was not going to be defined by the movie. And so he piled everybody into buses and took them over to the Mountain View Cineplex. And they all watched the movie in, I think, three theaters there. So he was able to overcome that and move on, and I think he's redefined himself as a result.
We're talking about Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, who's taking the social network that he so famously founded at Harvard public next week. Wonder what the Winklevoss twins are thinking. You remember the Social Network depicted how they sued over control of Facebook.
You must really hate the Winklevosses.
I don't hate anybody. The Winklevi aren't suing me for intellectual property theft. They are suing me because for the first time in their lives, things didn't work out the way they were supposed to for them.
We're speaking with former Wall Street internet analyst and founding CEO of Business Insider, Henry Blodgett. His New York Magazine story is entitled How the Brat Tycoon Became a Brilliant CEO. And Henry, you say Zuckerberg built one of the two strongest management teams out there, and people tell you he's really good at two important things, hiring and firing. And that seems unusual because, you know, after you watch the movie, he comes across as someone who just cuts people off. But you say he's developed real skills.
Absolutely. I mean, he seems in the movie very Machiavellian, and he doesn't care about people and so forth, and they're just social misfit and so on. And a couple of people that I talked to who work for Facebook, one of whom was fired by Mark along the way, they said, look, you know, first, to build a company like this, you've got to either be really, really good at hiring or really, really good at firing. And that's incredibly hard to do. And I think a lot of people felt screwed over by Mark along the way, some of whom now look back and say, look, yeah, I felt screwed over at the time, but it was the right decision for the company. And all I can say is, as a CEO, it is extremely difficult to make decisions where you're taking somebody that you feel incredibly loyal to, who has contributed so much to the organization, to say, look, basically, we need something else now. And he has risen to do that. And again, it doesn't make you popular, but it is very instrumental in building a company like that.
You also write about how when he recruits people, he takes them on this hike up a mountain behind a Facebook headquarters and sort of ends his pitch just as this beautiful vista is revealed.
And this is apparently what I was told is that that's something that Steve Jobs used to do all the time, is take people on walks around Palo Alto when he was recruiting them. And one person I spoke to said, well, Mark's innovation on that is that it's up this trail. And yes, the full vision is revealed just as you have this amazing view of the valley.
Well, a couple other things. You say that where some tech industries put too much emphasis on making money quick as opposed to worrying about the product, he's exactly the opposite. And he still has that theory of move fast and break things, which means if you need to put a product out there, put it out there without focus grouping it, let the buyers focus group it. And then you mentioned that he found, you know, the other half that he needed in this Sheryl Sandberg from Google, so much so that the new paradigm isn't go get a CEO for a Zuckerberg, it's go get a Sheryl for your
That's
CEO.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think a lot is revealed there. I think one thing that Mark Zuckerberg has said very clearly in the company's IPO prospectus, and this is something that anybody considering investing in the stock should take very seriously, is that to him, Facebook's social mission is more important than the company's business. That is very profound. And on Wall Street, that is heresy. Wall Street wants you to be totally focused on shareholder value, on the financials. And so the idea that somebody is saying right up front, I care more about the social mission and the product than I do the business, that is a big deal.
Well, in fact, I'm just going to interrupt for a second to say that he almost seemed to be saying to potential investors, you know, don't bother investing with us if you don't believe this, because he wrote in Facebook's IPO prospectus, you know, we don't build services to make money. We make money to build better services.
That's right. It really is a warning sign, especially to short-term investors, but even to folks who are used to companies where the mantra really is, you know, we're here obviously to make money, and the products are sort of a way of doing that. Facebook has reversed that. I think he has tapped into something very important there, but it's something that is unusual. And anybody who invests in the company has got to realize what it means, which is that in many cases, I expect, Mark Zuckerberg will make decisions that will hurt the stock price and will hurt the company's financial performance in the short term in order to hopefully create a more powerful product over the long term. And you have to be willing to make that trade-off.
For instance, buying Instagram with $1 billion, you know, as you're going into an IPO.
Perfect example, and perfect example of a lot of things. One thing that people are worried about is Mark Zuckerberg has so much control over this company. He's got 57% of the voting rights that, you know, this is crazy. This is a kid making these decisions. He doesn't have to consult anybody. And any investor in the company should realize that. He does not have to consult anybody. So if you don't believe in him, then forget it. Don't invest in the company. But the reason he bought Instagram was that what he saw is that mobile on smartphones and tablets is now taking over. And what he said is, Facebook doesn't do that. We're bad at mobile. This is a way to get us into the game in mobile, and it is worth 1% of my company to do that. And I actually think that was a shrewd move, but it scared the heck out of a lot of people that a CEO had that much control.
Well, to finish off the thought we brought up a while back, you can only do this, though, if you pick people to stand with you that agree with you. One is Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook's chief operating officer, made it clear she doesn't want to be CEO, obviously supports Mark Zuckerberg. Another is David Ebersman. He was hired in 2009 to manage the company, and he sort of shaped the IPO. Meantime, I want to touch on something you just said, Mark Zuckerberg's thinking about buying Instagram and getting into mobile. We recently had an analyst on who said, forget Facebook, it's going to be gone in 5 to 8 years. And his thinking was, that's precisely why, because they're not ready for the next platform, which is mobile phones and apps. So where do you come down on this? Is Facebook going to be around in more than 5 to 8 years? Are they going to be able to make it to the next platform?
Well, you've just laid out what a lot of professional investors are arguing about, and it's obviously critical to have the right answer to that question, which nobody has. I think this comes back to what we were saying earlier, which is that this is why you want a visionary in charge. The technology industry changes so quickly that if you don't have somebody who's trying to look over the horizon and figure out what's coming next as the leader, it doesn't matter how good a company you are. You can just sail into a backwater and that's it. So I have a lot of respect for the analysts who said they'll be gone in 5 years. I think it's unlikely. I think, in fact, more likely they will probably be being used by 3 to 4 billion people in the world. But it's anyone's bet. Technology changes so quickly, it's easy to be wrong.
That's Henry Blodgett, CEO and editor-in-chief of Business Insider. Henry, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
In Syria today, security forces foiled an attempted suicide car bombing, rather, in the northern city of Aleppo. State TV claiming the would-be bomber was killed before he could detonate more than 2,000 pounds of explosives. This follows yesterday's suicide bombings in the Syrian capital of Damascus. More than 50 people were killed. This is a ceasefire, part of the UN-brokered peace plan that has only seemed to increase the violence. The BBC's Lise Doucette is in Damascus. Lise, you were at the scene of the attack yesterday, then at the hospital where the injured were treated. You've been talking to family members. Who do they blame?
Well, there were absolutely horrific scenes at the closest hospital to the site of those two powerful explosions south of Damascus. So many body bags that the morgue simply didn't have enough space for all of them. There were relatives outside, anxious relatives and angry relatives too, and almost everyone we met started shouting and cursing the opposition and cursing also countries like Qatar and Saudi Arabia, which they accused of arming the opposition. At the scene of the blast as well, which was an absolute wasteland, there were angry crowds there as well, with some of them shouting slogans in support of Bashar al-Assad and again denouncing the opposition. But as always, there were a few people who quietly took us aside and said they believed it was the work of the government, and that is what the Syrian opposition, including the Free Syrian Army, are now saying, that this was another cynical attempt by the authorities in Damascus to discredit the opposition, to tarnish them as terrorists. But I think given what we're seeing in this kind of explosion, a more sophisticated, a coordinated explosion, there is a growing belief that there are actually other elements now that are trying to exploit this chaos, possibly Al-Qaeda. The U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has spoken about an Al-Qaeda presence. And so yet again, there seems to be this growing impression that the opposition, which is composed of so many different diverse groups, now includes elements which are bent on the worst kind of violence.
Even as members of the opposition are saying they didn't want to resort to violence. So you're agreeing with your colleague, Owen Bennett-Jones, who was here recently, who and others who are saying that Islamic elements might have sort of, you know, filled this vacuum between the regime of President Bashar al-Assad and the opposition. What are people in Damascus saying? And Lise, again, you know, for people who may just be poking their head up and watching this and thinking violence in the Middle East, well, that's nothing new. Damascus has been, you know, a sophisticated, cosmopolitan, relatively calm city.
6 months ago in Damascus, the area, sort of a 4 kilometer area in the center of the city, was described as a bubble where there weren't the kind of large protests or the violence that was seen in other major cities. But then months on, we saw elements of the Free Syrian Army taking up positions in the suburbs. And I can say that visiting some of the areas of Damascus again this time, they are much more restive. People seem much bolder, much more willing to take to the streets to denounce President Assad. And of course, yesterday's bomb blast just south of the capital has underlined to people in Damascus that they can't escape the worst of this violence. And I have to say, the streets of Damascus, we went around for a drive, are very quiet indeed, and a lot of people are choosing to stay indoors. There are still some protests today after Friday prayers, but for the most part, people are staying indoors, worried, and I think, of what will be the next threats and the next dangers to emerge in a conflict that's already gone on for 14 months. And as you started by saying, there are new groups becoming involved simply because this is a very unstable situation. In the midst of chaos, many groups are trying to take advantage of it. And there is also still, though, a peaceful opposition, the peaceful protesters who started this off in March of last year and now feel completely eclipsed as the uprising takes ever more violent turns.
Yeah, quite something. The BBC's Lise Doucette in Damascus, Syria. Lise, take care and thank you.
Thanks.
Today in Greensboro, North Carolina, U.S. District Judge Catherine Eagles turned down a request from John Edwards' defense lawyers to drop corruption charges against him, saying that there's now, after 14 days of testimony, enough evidence to allow jurors to decide his fate. That means the defense will begin their defense next week. Edwards is, of course, accused of masterminding a scheme to use nearly $1 million in secret payments from two wealthy donors to help hide his pregnant mistress, Muriel Hunter, as he sought the Democratic presidential nomination in 2008. He faces up to 30 years in prison if convicted on all counts. Prosecutors rested their case yesterday by playing a tape of a 2008 ABC interview in which John Edwards repeatedly lies about his extramarital affair with Hunter, denying he fathered her baby, and then goes on to say he knew nothing of a well-financed cover-up.
I've never asked anybody to pay a dime of money, never been told that any money's been paid. Nothing has been done at my request. So if the allegation is that somehow I participated in the payment of money, that is a lie, an absolute lie.
North Carolina Public Radio's Jeff DeBeery has been in the courtroom. Jeff, how did Edwards react when that tape was played in the courtroom?
He put a finger to his nose, kind of the inner bridge of his nose, a couple of times for maybe a minute or two, still for the most part. His chin was buried in his fist for several long moments. He wasn't as crimson in the face as he has been during some of the other emotional testimony, so relatively subdued, not a lot of outward emotion, if you will.
Well, the New York Times is saying that this moment might be one that comes back to haunt John Edwards. Is that because next to his claim that he never lied about the money were outright lies about Riel Hunter and his relationship with her?
That's right. Here he is, the defendant, the presidential candidate turned defendant, sitting and watching a video of himself lying. And it was a weird dynamic. And, of course, the merits of this case, as the judge reminded the jury on the front end, don't have anything to do with him being a bad husband or a failed politician. They have to do with campaign finance law. But the bottom line is that there are some real human elements here. And how the jury views this man, this flawed human person, very well could come back to haunt him as they turn out a verdict.
Well, for instance, there was that moment when Jennifer Palmieri, a close friend and former spokeswoman for John Edwards' wife, Elizabeth, who died of breast cancer in 2010, she took the stand and talked about how Elizabeth had told her of fears of dying unloved. You know, just a heartbreaking moment.
Very sad. And we've had several tearful witnesses testifying in this case. And with that moment, you almost wonder, the line of questioning, it was actually under cross-examination. And the defense attorney, Abby Lowell, was asking Palmieri about this final moment, the final moments of her life. And here she is talking about how John Edwards was with his wife after all of this. And it was emotional, but not lost entirely in that emotion was the fact that the defense was trying to play up Edwards' role as a husband who had kind of stuck through it, somebody who had been forgiven. And I don't think that was entirely lost.
Well, could you tell? I mean, I'm wondering, as you sit in the courtroom and watch, can you see the jury react? Do their eyes go to John Edwards when something like this is being discussed?
That's a tough question. No, I can't tell. No one can tell at this point. This is a jury that has been very engaged for the most part. There have been a couple of instances with jurors dozing off, but for the most part, they're watching closely. They're watching the witnesses. It looks like they're reading facial cues. They're looking at Edwards. They're closely watching the defense attorneys. They're closely watching David Harbach and the U.S. attorneys, the prosecution side of things. But at this point, we haven't talked to them. Who knows what they're really thinking?
How they're taking it in. Well, just if you would for us, a laundry list, please. Tick off how prosecutors rebutted his John Edwards' claims that he did not know about the money that changed hands to hide his relationship with Riel Hunter.
They called former campaign aides and advisors. They called associates to one of the wealthy donors, Rachel Bunny Mellon, and also officials from the Federal Election Commission and the FBI. They showed hundreds of more than 100 pieces of evidence, phone records and receipts from the plane receipts and receipts that were used as part of the effort to cover up the affair with Riel Hunter and move her around the country. Large largely circumstantial. None of the checks that we saw were made out to John Edwards, were from John Edwards, or even passed through his camp, his family, his address. So a lot of this is connecting the dots, and a lot of this, by what the law experts have said at the courthouse, really is circumstantial.
So there's been nothing where somebody told of shadowy conversations with John Edwards, where he said anything about taking money from donors and doing this. That hasn't come up.
No, and he has really maintained, you know, the defense here is that this wasn't breaking the law. This did not violate campaign finance law. There have been some pieces of testimony that indicate he was aware there was an effort to move Riel Hunter, his mistress, to different parts of the country, but there has not been that smoking gun, if you will, where someone says, well, Mr. Edwards was aware of this $35,000 payment in November of 2007. There hasn't been anything that explicit.
Well, and so the prosecution rested without calling Riel Hunter to the stand. Do you have a sense of why they didn't? There has not been a very attractive picture painted of her. And will the defense call her to the stand?
Starting with the prosecution, they did not call her because she's viewed as a bit of a wild card, a bit of a loose cannon. And while they could have asked her very pointed questions under direct, you don't know what she's going to do under cross-examination. She still sees John Edwards. John Edwards has a role in raising their child together. You don't know what kind of loyalties are there, and you didn't know what was going to happen if she went on the stand. Now, some criticized the prosecution for not bringing her in. They said not putting her in that witness box leaves perhaps some question with the jurors. You know, why didn't they see her? Why didn't they hear from her? Is the government hiding something? So that's both sides of it. You certainly can see it both ways. As for the defense, I think the good to come out of it could be that, you know, maybe she humanizes John Edwards more. Maybe she testifies that the money she received was secret from him and they were trying to keep the money away from him. And again, that's maybe. But the bad could be portrayed again as a bit of a loose cannon. I would be a little bit surprised if she's called by the defense.
And in the minute we have, Jeff, what about John Edwards himself? Will he take the stand?
A mixed bag there. Some have said that, no, he will not take the stand because if he goes up there, it opens the proverbial can of worms. It puts a giant target on his back, and the prosecution will just go after him and unleash him on him. The other side of it is that a former federal prosecutor told me it's very hard to keep somebody who has spent his career convincing juries as a trial lawyer and convincing the American public as a politician off of the stand and away from this opportunity to tell his story. So it's really mixed at this point.
Fascinating. Jeff Tiberi, North Carolina Public Radio, covering the John Edwards trial in Greensboro. Jeff, thanks so much. We'll stay in touch with you.
Thanks, Robin.
Now, when you think of your mom this Mother's Day, will there be a fragrance to go with that memory? Maybe banana bread or homemade pie. I've mentioned before that the thought of tuna noodle casserole with canned soup and topped with crunched up potato chips can bring me to my knees. Well, we asked you for family recipes to mark Mother's Day, and boy, did we hear from you. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst joins us from her beautiful kitchen up in Maine with a look at Here and Now recipes from Mom. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Robin.
And boy, what did you think?
I think we touched a nerve. I was so overwhelmed by the responses and the comments we got. I mean, I sat at my computer and a few tears dropped down there. I mean, beautiful, beautiful stories. What it turns out is that people's memories of their mothers and grandmothers and aunts are so much based in the kitchen. They're so much based around a recipe that's been passed down. And the truth is that when you get into the kitchen and you turn on the stove and you start chopping those ingredients and you start to smell those smells again from your childhood, really huge sensory memories come up. I would say, in fact, that cooking a recipe from your mother is a stronger, more powerful emotional memory than wearing her clothes, being in her house, looking at her letters, more than anything.
Well, and even though both you and I think we could agree, had moms that weren't, you know, the greatest cooks, but there was something about, you know, just their recipes. And Richard Frizzell sent us his mom's recipe for cream chip beef, but he said everyone remembers his mom, Kathleen Sarah Frizzell, for her pies. You have his note there.
I do. You know, this was really kind of typical of some of them, just beautiful. He writes, one of the things mom could do in amazing fashion was bake pies. all flavors and types. We honor her each year with a pie baking contest held during our family Christmas gathering. The award being Grandma's Rolling Pin, mounted on a plaque with brass nameplates of the winners.
Isn't that something? What a great idea.
I love it. I mean, it's such a really unique way of keeping these recipes alive and honoring tradition and honoring these great ladies of the kitchen.
Well, and we're going to post all of these notes, but Richard also talked about photo albums put together with pictures and recipes, seasoning skillets. His mom seasoned skillets and gave them as gifts. So we'll have all of these notes in full posted at our website. Meanwhile, many of the recipes themselves were sent. I'm looking at one. This is from Leslie Bush. It's a tattered old index card. It has her mom's handwritten recipe for banana bread. What did she write, Kathy?
Well, you know, this is another beautiful thing. The copies of these recipes, they look like they're, you know, from an old black and white movie or some gorgeous photography exhibit you'd see at a museum of modern art, sort of an archive of the old kitchen. So Leslie writes, "My mom is 72, still cooking wonderful dishes in the sixth kitchen of her adult life. This is the banana bread recipe she wrote out for me when I got married 25 plus years ago. Her creative use of ingredients and constant tracking of the household inventory taught me not to waste food, cycling items through original dishes, leftovers, and in a pinch, cream of dying vegetable soup."
Dying vegetable. I love that.
I do too. You know, Robin, it makes you realize the importance of passing on recipes from generation to generation.
One of our producers, Emiko Tamagawa, has a recipe from her mom that she thought she'd lost after her mom passed, and then it tumbled out of one of her own recipe files, and she remembered her mom had written it out for Emiko when she got married, and Emiko's copied it for her siblings. But she's kept the original, and she made one for us, which this is all by way of explaining I'm eating it right now, and it's just delicious. And to be able to have that, you know, from your mom.
It's so excellent that she thought it was lost, and it's found, and now she's cooked it for you.
Right, so it's not lost at all. We also heard from Sean Hayes in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. His family would always gather in October to cook up massive batches of his grandma Knudsen's lefse. Now, this is Norwegian flatbread. It tastes like tortillas, softer maybe. He sent us a copy, but all he had from her was, you know, scrawled on this food-stained piece of paper, 6 cups of potatoes, 2 teaspoons salt, 4 tablespoons shortening, 3/4 cup salt. You know, what do you do with it? You know, his grandma eventually died, succumbed to cancer, and they decided to make the lefse, and, you know, they had to figure it out.
So we had to figure out how to rice the potatoes, that you have to soak the potatoes overnight. We kind of had a general idea, but this was the first time we had to do it. It's amazing to me that we have this recipe. Our family came here, you know, over 100 years ago from Norway, and this is like the only recipe people have made a point to move it along the generations. It's something that survived from Europe.
So something that, as Sean from Milwaukee says, survived decades. We've got all these recipes and notes posted at hereandnow.org. And some of them I have, as I said, made right in front of me. I've been nibbling on Kathleen McKenna's mom's Queen Elizabeth cake. Just gorgeous. And listen to the sound, Kathy.
Tuna noodle casserole.
That would be my family. This is just mac and cheese. Rachel Rohr, one of our producers, brought it in. And it's that squish sound, you know, it's just comfort food.
Well, I was just going to say, so much of this is comfort food. They're the recipes that are full of emotion and full of childhood taste, and that people want just to bring back all those emotions.
And in this case, the mac and cheese is full of love, and in Rachel Rohr's family, full of celery seeds, which it's just a different taste.
Oh, nice.
Well, we also heard from people on Twitter. Their messages were shorter, but no less poignant. Whitney R. writes, "Whoopie pies. My New Hampshire mom perfected the recipe. Moist chocolate cakes with buttery vanilla filling." And our friends at New Hampshire Public Radio's Word of Mouth sent a recipe from the 70s. It's called Tennessee Peach Pudding, vanilla wafers, sliced peaches, all different, all great. And as Kathleen Hoag said, she wrote in her mom's recipe for Russian tea cakes, "It's an honor." You know, it's honoring them.
That's exactly it. It is a complete honoring of the past and of the traditions. And like all kinds of history. This is culinary history. This is personal culinary history, and it's vital.
We got so many stories. Anne Riesenfeld of Sudbury, Mass. Sent in her Omis, her grandma's chicken soup recipe. Now, her grandmother had survived the Holocaust. As she used to say, she thinks now God forgot about her because she lived such a long life. Anne sent out her grandma's recipe for chicken soup in 2008 in celebration of her grandmother's 100th birthday. But it was very hard for her to nail it down because sometimes, you know, grandmas, moms who've been making these things for so long, they're not, you know, they think, well, you know what to do.
Exactly. A pinch of this, a pinch of that.
So let's listen.
So I called her and it was sort of this funny back and forth where it felt a little bit like pulling teeth, you know, ah, to God, don't put too much water. So then I would say, okay, so what else? Vegetables? And she'd say, of course vegetables. Well, which vegetables? Well, soup vegetables, she'd say. And I think it was just that she was assuming that it was common sense. Everybody knows how to make chicken soup. And the big thing with Omi's chicken soup is that, and this is the trick, this is the secret, is that you don't put too much water in the pot. And the soup has to gel in the refrigerator overnight. If it doesn't gel, it's not going to have enough flavor. And we all make it. My sister and I, on the day that we found out that Omi died, we, unbeknownst to each other, we each made chicken soup that day. It's just what connects us. And the first question is, did it gel?
That's such a great story. I just love that.
And then, by the way, Omi lived to 104.
Lucky Anne for having that recipe and keeping it going.
Kathy Gunst, our resident chef up there in Maine, thanks so much for helping us compile these.
Thank you, and happy Mother's Day to all, and write those recipes down. Bring those kids into the kitchen. Keep those recipes alive. You will not regret it.